my great joy and privilege to be standing here sharing with you from the Word of God. We're kind of hard-pressed for time. As you may be aware, last Sunday we started a new series on the book of Ecclesiastes, and today is the second installment in the series with the sermon title of The Teacher's Search for Meaning. The sermon text is really long, stretching a chapter and a half from chapter 1, verse 12, and all the way to the end of chapter 2, verse 26. We certainly don't have the time to examine each verse in detail, but we will do our best to walk through the verses to paint a picture of what the writer is lamenting about. And the text can be divided into four separate but connected segments. You saw four slides earlier on. We will examine them one by one and derive some important lessons that we can take home with us. These 44 verses before us are an expansion of what we heard last Sunday when we saw how the writer opens chapter 1 with a sense of frustration or exasperation, as he famously proclaims, "Meaningless, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless." Or in the King James Version, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Because he sees in chapter 1, verse 4, how generations come and go, and he likens it to the rising and the setting of sun, to the blowing of wind, to the flowing of rivers into the sea. We are born, we live, and we die. Human life is a cycle, and the writer sees nothing but futility and weariness in the pointless pursuits of life. In our text today, the writer will explain in depth why he comes to this sad conclusion about life, or rather the meaning of life, or the lack of. You can detect a deep sense of pessimism and cynicism as he wrestles with big questions such as, what's the point of it all? Why was I even born? What's the purpose of living? And where can I find meaning? And incredibly, such questions, which were implicitly asked by the writer some 3,000 years ago, are still as relevant and common today as they were in ancient times. Before we continue, shall we commit this time to the Lord in prayer? Our Father in heaven, is life as pointless and wearisome as the writer of Ecclesiastes describes it to be? Or is there a deeper meaning and a greater purpose behind our existence? Open the eyes of our faith as we study this portion of Scripture. Help us look beyond the material and consider what's beneath the surface as we examine these verses. And we ask this in the name of our Lord Jesus. Amen. Now let me begin by showing you a video recorded in 2010. This is going to be a short one. During the 44th anniversary dinner of Public Bank. And the video features the chairman of Public Bank, you know well, Dr. Tay Hong Piao, who is one of the richest men in the country, and you will hear him sing "My Way," the song popularized by Frank Sinatra. Now, I know many of you are very familiar with this song, but I want you to hear it again, especially sung by this immensely rich man. And please reflect on the words as he sings, because you will soon see they exemplify the very opposite of what we have in Ecclesiastes 1 and 2. And I want this to be an introduction to the sermon, because it serves as an antithesis of what we are going to learn. Can we have the video, please? Dr. Tay Hong Piao. Thank you.
Okay, I think we have heard enough, okay? Sorry to put you through all this. Now, to be sure, the crowd applauded him, not so much because of his singing skills, we must admit. If not for his position and wealth, I think they would have asked him to get off the stage after 10 seconds. Because here we have a highly successful man, successful by the standards of most people and certainly of the crowd, and telling the world how he did it his way. Now, this YouTube video, you can see in YouTube, recorded fewer than 10,000 hits, which is surprising to me because Public Bank alone employs more than 20,000 employees. And it goes to show that if you're at the event, you have no choice but to clap, but out in cyberspace, nobody cares about an old man singing. Which also goes to show that we should never live by man's praise, man's empty praise. Rather, we should strive to gain God's approval. Now, if you remember the words from this hymn, riches I heed not, nor man's empty praise. Thou mine inheritance, now and always. Now, more interestingly, there are only two comments to this video out of less than 10,000 hits, which is not too surprising now. And one of them at the bottom describes our banker as a man of wisdom, which I find rather bizarre, because we will soon see from our text the utter folly of human wisdom. But let's set aside this video because I want to share with you something else more bizarre that happened to me recently. 3 weeks ago, my wife and I, we were in Taipei for a short holiday. We were a party of six, including five ladies. So you know, the only guy now. I was the cameraman, I was the tour guide, I was the group leader, I was the bodyguard, all rolled into one. On the second day, I found myself in a crowded train. Now, Taipei has a very modern MRT network. And so I was standing in this train packed with passengers, when suddenly an elderly lady, older than me, stood up and offered me her seat. Of course, I declined the offer. It wouldn't be so bad if a strong young man had offered me his seat. But coming from an elderly lady, it made me feel very, very old. The point I'm making is this. Now, I may deny that I'm old, I may think I'm still young, but she saw me as old and frail. She must be half blind, I think. But jokes aside, the truth is I'll be 58 this year, and the inescapable fact is that with each passing year, we are one step closer to the end of our journey on Earth. With each birthday, we inch closer to the grave. And the reality of death, you'll see later, is very explicit in the middle of chapter 2, but we'll come to that later. Now, another way of putting that thought across is this saying, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Some people add a second part to the quote, today is the first day of the rest of your life, make it a good one. Or today is the first day of the rest of your life, celebrate it. But I wish to propose to you, especially in the context of Ecclesiastes, that today is the first day of the rest of your life, and it's something you need to think about, something you need to think about deeply, because you've got to decide what you're going to do about it. And ever since I crossed the half-century mark of my life, I've thought long and hard about life and the meaning of life. When I was younger, I had no time for such philosophical exercises. I was too busy doing things my way,
getting a degree, advancing my career, getting married, and raising my children. And with that largely behind me now, over the past 8 years or so, the matters concerning my faith have become very important to me. According to the Department of Statistics, the average lifespan of a Malaysian Chinese male is 75.0 years. And for a Malaysian Chinese female, it is 79.9 years. And so if I divide 58 by 75, that is if I live to 75, I'm in the last quarter of my life, the sunset years, so to speak. And at a quickened pace, my way is increasingly being replaced by God's way. But I don't wish to give you the conclusion of the sermon so soon, and so let us get on with the text. Now, in any study of Ecclesiastes, one question it is often asked, who exactly is the author of the book who calls himself the teacher? And this is a repeat of chapter 1, verse 1, where he says the words of the teacher. And as Pastor Mark remarked last Sunday, his identity is kind of ambiguous. This teacher who comes across, as a very wise old man. Now, the traditional view is that the teacher is none other than King Solomon, because it says here in chapter 1, verse 12, I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And this is again echoed in chapter 1, verse 1, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. And Solomon was indeed king of Israel, and he was also the son of David. But there are many Bible scholars who beg to differ. They argue that the author is someone else, someone who assumed the character of Solomon, someone who wrote as if he was Solomon. But this debate has no great impact on our study. But for our purpose today, we will just take the view that the writer was Solomon. And as I mentioned at the beginning, our text is divided into four segments. In the first segment, from chapter 1, verses 12 to 18, we see why the teacher is so pessimistic and cynical in the earlier verses. Because he has been thinking very hard about all the activities that human beings are engaged in. Verse 13, he says, I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. He has been using his intellect to consider what is going on in this world. Verse 14, he says, I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. Next, the teacher even thinks about wisdom itself and the opposite of wisdom, which is madness and folly. Verse 17, then I applied my mind, myself, to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. In other words, he was using his wisdom to consider wisdom and also the lack of wisdom. That's a bit deep. But each time he comes out disappointed, whether he contemplates the world around him using wisdom or whether he considers wisdom itself, the conclusion is the same. A chasing after the wind. All are devoid of meaning. He sees them as hollow. Now, the phrase chasing after the wind should be rightly translated as herding the wind, from the word herd, H-E-R-D. It's an agricultural term. With domestic animals, you can chase after them and place them into a pen. But how do you gather the wind? That's the meaning of chasing after the wind. It's an impossible task, a futile endeavor. And do you notice that verses 13 to 15 and then verses 16 to 18 are somewhat parallel? In each case, the teacher sets out by thinking really hard. I applied my mind, he says. But each time he comes to the same depressing conclusion, a chasing after the wind. And each time he makes it even more depressing by citing a negative proverb. In verse 15, what is crooked cannot be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted. And in verse 18, the second proverb, for with much wisdom comes much sorrow, the more knowledge, the more grief. What is crooked cannot be straightened simply means that we live in the fallen world and there is nothing you can do to right it. What is lacking cannot be counted is to say what is missing cannot be recovered, from the New Living Translation. And it's complementary to the first phrase, as it means what is deficient cannot be made whole. But verse 18 needs elaboration. With much wisdom comes much knowledge. The more knowledge, the more grief. I need to explain, lest you think that wisdom and knowledge are bad for you. The teacher finds the searching for meaning using his wisdom to be such an unhappy business, so much so that wisdom brings much sorrow and knowledge results in more grief. In other words, the more you think, the more you think about it, the sadder you become. And so do you think that we should stop thinking? Should we forget about wisdom and knowledge, as implied by the writer? My friends sometimes tell me that I'm cursed with a mind that thinks too much. They say it's the cause of the white hair. Ignorance is bliss, they advise me. Don't think too much. Well, certainly there are times when you're better off not doing something. That I agree. There are times when verse 18 rings true. Let me give you an example. This is just an example. Suppose I tell you that Dr. Peter loves to drink beer. He drops by the pub a few times a week on his way back from the hospital. But this may affect your high image of him as elder, you know. Especially if you think that Christians shouldn't drink beer, because some of you may associate beer with drunkenness. And so in this particular case, you are better off not knowing that Dr. Peter is a drinker. But hey, this is just an example, okay? Don't go and admonish him, you know, this is an example. Only. I don't know what he likes to drink, maybe just plain water, okay? But in any case, my position is that drinking beer is not exactly a sin, you know? Just don't get drunk and don't lose control of yourself. And here is the golden rule of life. Everything in moderation. Avoid the extremes and the excesses of life, and then you'll be okay. So at times, yes, ignorance is bliss. But most times, wisdom and knowledge will do you a lot of good. More often than not, it's better to know than not to know. For example, if your car brakes are faulty, it's better for you to know and to do something about it. If you have a tumor in your body, then it's very important that you know so that you can seek early treatment. And hence, in verse 18, in saying that wisdom brings much sorrow and knowledge more grief, the teacher is not dismissing the benefits of wisdom and knowledge. It's just his way of underscoring his deep sense of frustration about that his wisdom and knowledge have failed to provide him the answers that he seeks regarding the meaning of life. The teacher considers himself to be very wise. From verse 16, look, I've increased in wisdom more than anyone. Indeed, Solomon is considered to be the wisest man who has ever lived. But for all the extent of his wisdom, the teacher still fails to find answers to the meaning of life. And that makes him even more frustrated. In fact, earlier he has already expressed his sense of despair in verse 13. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. And indeed, in the King James Version, this segment is given the title, The Grief of Wisdom. And this sets the stage for the remainder of our text, which will be easier to digest. In the following three segments, which are in chapter 2, the teacher sets out to try out three experiments to see if indeed all is vanity, if indeed everything is meaningless. He decides to venture out to confirm whether his earlier conclusions about life are true. Perhaps somewhere out there, you know, he could find something more substantial. He says in verse 3b, I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their life. And so in the second segment from chapter 2, verses 1 to 11, the teacher starts to engage in all kinds of pleasure that the world could possibly offer. Verse 1 says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. And further down, verse 10, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. So he decides to indulge himself, to enjoy life to the maximum. And what does he do with this experiment? There is this catalog of his activities from verse 3 to verse 8. All kinds of pleasure he starts to sample. In verse 3, he tries alcohol and some silly stuff that come with it. He tries to cheer himself with wine. I don't think they had beer in those days. But beer would be an apt modern equivalent. And next, from verses 4 to 6, The teacher undertakes several building projects. He builds for himself houses complete with vineyards and gardens, with parks and pools. He seeks to delight himself in dwellings of much splendor and luxury. And this piece of property would be something similar in today's time. Although I cannot understand the logic behind such mansions, I mean, how many rooms does a man need? In verse 7, the teacher, who is obviously very wealthy, then fills his mansions with male and female slaves to serve him and to wait upon him. What good are all his lovely mansions without the human accessories? And of course, today we no longer have slaves in our house, but some of us may have servants and maids, cooks and gardeners. And the teacher continues with his experiment. Next in his list, he acquires herds and flocks to a scale that has never been seen before. Of course, today nobody keeps cattle and sheep in their houses, but we have replaced the animals with the sedans and MPVs and SUVs. And this is the fleet of luxury car owned by a very wealthy sultan in Southeast Asia, shall I just say. And the same question is asked, how many cars does a man need? And we are not done yet. Next, the teacher tries to amass gold and silver and various other treasures. Perhaps it will make him feel happier to be able to feel and touch his wealth. The modern equivalent of this would be the money we keep in our bank. We no longer, you know, put it under the pillow, in addition to all the other financial assets such as stocks and shares. But to some people, hard cash seems to be more satisfying. And this is a part of the 114 million ringgit seized from two corrupt government officers in October last year, just recently, not too far away from here in Sabah. And it included 53 million ringgit in cash, which they kept at home. How stupid. Which took 30 officers 15 hours to count. Now, it seems that the pleasures of alcohol, mansions, servants, cars, and money still leave the teacher empty. And so now he has male and female singers coming to entertain him with songs and music. Maybe they can cheer him up. Now, today it's very expensive to hire singers to come to your house to sing for you. And so we go to where the singers are performing to enjoy their music. And this is the Rolling Stones concert in Los Angeles in 1981. And what do we hear them sing? They sing, I can't get no satisfaction. Which is ironic because the fans have gone there to seek satisfaction, you know. And so after a long experiment, possibly stretching a lifetime, the teacher tries the last pleasure of life, said to be the highest pleasure, which is sexual gratification. He acquires a harem, described here as the delights of a man's heart, which can only mean one thing, women. Indeed, in 1 Kings 11:3, we read that King Solomon has 700 wives and 300 concubines. And so it was quite a harem with 1,000 women to please him. And incidentally, the word harem comes from the Arabic word harim, which means prohibition. And it refers to the section of the palace, you know, where the concubines are kept, into which other men, except the king, are forbidden to enter. And that's why the word harim means prohibition. And interestingly, from the word harim, from this Arabic word harim, we get the Malay word haram, which in this country comes to mean prohibition against pigs and dogs. Anyway, when it comes to sexual pleasures, King Solomon went to the extreme, thinking that it would satisfy him. Now, although not to the extent of Solomon, there is no shortage of modern examples of men living promiscuous lifestyle, having multiple partners, keeping numerous mistresses, or visiting prostitutes. Now, I can't show you a picture of a man sleeping around. It wouldn't be appropriate. But in every other instance of what the teacher did, I showed you a modern equivalent, from a mansion to servants, from cars to music. And I did this to illustrate that the desires of men have not really changed in 3,000 years. People today behave more or less the same way as their ancestors did centuries ago. And the teacher, being very wise, he knew this in his time. And that's why he says earlier in the chapter 1, verse 9, what has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. And just as the teacher discovered that worldly pleasures left him empty, similarly, people today have discovered, or are discovering, or will discover that the pleasures of the physical kind will result in emptiness. And the teacher knew what he was saying, because he tried all kinds of pleasures, literally all kinds. The only pleasure missing in his list is food. And do you know why he omitted the pleasure of food? Because Solomon was not Chinese. If Solomon were Chinese, food would be the first thing on his list. But in any case, at the end of this experiment on pleasures, the teacher makes a sad conclusion in verse 11. When I surveyed all that my hands had done, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. And again, this phrase, a chasing after the wind, herding the wind. In short, nothing left him with a sense of purpose. And he actually knew this at the beginning of this segment, because earlier he wrote in verse 1b, but that also proved to be meaningless. And he continued in verse 2, laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? Now, he doesn't mean that you shouldn't laugh. He's not disapproving laughter per se. But he was speaking against the laughter of pleasure rather than the laughter of joy. Now, I know many of you already know that we cannot find pleasures, we cannot find purpose in the pleasures of the world. They only result in emptiness. Now, I found this wonderful picture to illustrate this point. And apparently, this emptiness grows exponentially as you approach the end of your journey on earth. And many of us know there is more to life than what the material world can offer. And that's why we come to church every Sunday, on other days as well, hoping to find something deeper, something more substantive. But there are many out there who persist in their mistaken belief that worldly pleasures can satisfy their soul, and they can be your spouse or your children or your parents. And I pray that God will guide you to reach out to them, to open their eyes to the deeper truths of life. Now, having found out to his despair that worldly pleasures are devoid of meaning, we continue. The teacher tries another experiment in the third segment of our text from chapter 2. Now, the next portion, verses 12 to 16. And this is a shorter passage that we can cover quickly. Now, earlier in the first segment, we already seen how the teacher was so disappointed that for all his wisdom, he couldn't figure out the meaning of life. And he became very depressed. But in this second experiment, he has a new thought. That although wisdom and knowledge may have failed me in as far as the big questions of life are concerned, but maybe intellectual activities can bring me some meaning. If the pursuits of worldly pleasures are futile, maybe reading and learning, acquiring knowledge and gaining wisdom can bring me some joy and fulfillment. Now, this is a segment that really got me interested, because I'm not so hung up about worldly pleasures, but I really love to read and learn. And my wife can testify to this. She complains that I buy too many books. And there are books in the kitchen, books in the bedroom, even in the toilet, and not counting thousands more in my study. And my wife sometimes teases me, hey, when are you going to finish reading all these books? In the afterlife, maybe. Because to me, reading and learning is a joy. And so in this second experiment, the teacher ventures out to consider wisdom and its opposite, madness and folly. He wants to test out wisdom and knowledge, like how he tested pleasures. And lo and behold, in verse 13, he finds that wisdom is better than folly. That's why earlier I said it's better to know than not to know. Just as light is better than darkness, which is not unexpected for me at least. Because he associates wisdom with light, folly with darkness. And he then appends a proverb in verse 14, the wise have eyes in their heads, while the fools walks in the darkness. In other words, wisdom is more superior to folly. It is more beneficial to be wise than to be foolish, so that we don't walk in darkness. And darkness here includes spiritual darkness. And this certainly squares with the teacher's other teachings about wisdom and folly elsewhere in the Bible. For example, in Proverbs 13:20, walk with the wise and become wise, for a companion of fools suffers harm. So far, all well and good. But wait, the teacher suddenly hits another snag. He suddenly realizes that both the wise and the foolish suffer the same fate from verses 14b and 15a. He's talking about death. Whether you are wise or foolish, clever or stupid, you will die one day. Death is the ultimate equalizer. Everyone ends up in the grave. And he writes at the end of the passage, like the fool, the wise too must die. This in itself is not nothing profound. We all know this, although we don't want to talk about it. It's part of the natural cycle of life. But what the teacher concludes in the next part is what we need to know. From verse 16, he observes that after they are long gone, both the wise and the foolish will not be remembered, say, two or at most three generations later. And what's the point then if your wisdom will be forgotten by your descendants, if your knowledge will be erased by the sand of time? Let me give you an example from our Taipei trip. After the picture I showed you just now, we walk across a square to visit this memorial of Chiang Kai-shek, who founded the modern nation of Taiwan in 1949. He died in 1935. Now, my late father, he knew a lot about this guy. I know a little, not more than a little, I know something about this guy. My children know nothing about him. You see? Two generations, he's forgotten. And there were hordes of tourists at the site, but many, they have little idea of what this great man has accomplished. They were there to take pictures. At least Chiang Kai-shek has a large statue and history books for people to remember him. But you and I are not so famous. We will be completely forgotten long after our demise. And to cite another example, if you recall our illustrious banker, Dr. Tay Hong Piao, whose video you saw just now, two or three generations down the road, if public banks still exist, very few of the employees will remember his name, much less know about his life and his achievements and his ways. And that's why the teacher arrives at the same sad conclusion as the early experiment. He laments in verse 15b, what then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless. You come to the last of three experiments. After testing out pleasures and wisdom and ending up disillusioned, he comes to the last experiment, toil or work, to see if it will provide him some meaning. Now, if you're the type who's married to the job, who puts in long hours into the business, this last segment will be very relevant to you. The third experiment and the fourth and last segment covers chapter 2, verses 17 to 23. And you'll see all over the passage the teacher describing work to be tough and demanding. He says in verse 17, the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. In verse 20, he talks about my toilsome labor under the sun. Or in verse 22, the toil and anxious striving. To him, work is grief and pain from verse 23. Now, those of you who have been working very hard can understand this. It is not easy to put food on the table. The long hours, the deadlines, the meetings, the pressure, etc. And generally, Asians, especially the Chinese, they work too hard. But among the major ethnic groups in the country, strangely, the Chinese enjoy the longest average lifespan. And sadly, the Indian male in this country has the shortest lifespan.
The Chinese work very hard, and yet they live longer. Makes you wonder why. Should be the other way around, right? I think I know why. Because the Chinese really enjoy working and derive a lot of satisfaction from making a lot of money. And hence, the teacher here in this last segment has something to say, especially to the Chinese. In this last segment, he has two issues about deriving satisfaction or meaning from work. First, in verse 18, he complains that after toiling the sun, after so much struggle, all that he has worked so hard for, he says, I must leave them to the one who comes after me. Which is not too bad because after all, they are your children and grandchildren. His issue is in verse 19. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish, yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil. Meaning, there is a good chance that his stupid son or his son's stupid son will squander away his wealth. His second issue is in verse 21. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another one who has not toiled for it. This is the second problem. And taking a cue from this verse, my wife and I have told our children over the years that mommy and daddy will be spending most of our money. Not leaving much for them. We plan to spend it on traveling to see the world because we love to travel. And perhaps give away the rest to charity. The kids have to work for their own living and fund their own lifestyle. To use a local phrase, where I got such thing, I work, you enjoy. Or in Malay, mana boleh. That is exactly what he's saying here. And so on these two counts in verses 18 to 21, the teacher finds work to be meaningless. And he says this not once, but four times in this segment. He even describes it to be a great misfortune. In short, work, like pleasures and wisdom before this, cannot satisfy the soul. And all physical pursuits of life are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing makes sense to him. Now, the critical lesson behind all these three experiments by the teacher can be summed up by the words of this millionaire surgeon, I read about him, who lived and worked in Singapore. The late Dr. Richard Teo ran a hugely successful cosmetic surgery clinic in Singapore. And he really lived it up. He was young and good-looking, had plenty of money. He was into fast cars and had celebrities for company. And he really loved his high society lifestyle. And that went on until early 2011, when Dr. Teo was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And sadly, he passed away the following year at the age of 40. Now, the following is part of a transcript of his testimony in November 2011 to the Dental Christian Fellowship while he was undergoing treatment. And he says, this is a verbal testimony, it's not written, but it was. This is a transcript. In my deathbed, I found no joy whatsoever in whatever objects I had, my Ferrari, thinking of the land I was going to buy to build my bungalow, etc., having a successful business. It brought me zero comfort, zero joy, nothing at all. Do you think I can hold on to this piece of metal and it's going to give true joy? No, it's not going to happen. Now, against the backdrop of our text today, what we observe here is that 5 years ago, this dying man learned the hard way exactly what the teacher discovered 3,000 years ago, that you're not going to find meaning and fulfillment in the material world. Now, this is the main message from our text. But if you were to end the sermon here, it would leave a big gap in our discussion. It would be like watching a movie without a great ending. Because these four segments put together beg that one question. They point to that one great mystery. And that is, how and where can we find the true meaning of life? How can we live life meaningfully according to its real purpose? But unfortunately, the teacher doesn't exactly provide the answers in our text. Not in chapters 1 and 2. You see, it's only at the end of the book, in the last chapter, that the teacher leaves us with some clues to this mystery. Two clues, actually, in chapter 12. And so since the question of what's the meaning of life is not answered in our text, let's jump briefly to chapter 12 and look briefly at two verses there. And I shall leave you with some thoughts to ponder over. And the question of the true meaning of life will be fully addressed by another preacher when we come to chapter 12 in August. Now, the first clue is in chapter 12, verse 1. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. And so first, the teacher says to remember your Creator when you are young, not when you're already old. The earlier, the better. Because the truth of the matter is, you can only find true meaning of life in God. So the earlier you know Him and relate to Him, the more meaningful your life is. And the longer you will live a meaningful life. And coming back to the story of Dr. Teo, you should know that he was baptized when he was 20 years before he died. But he soon abandoned God to pursue his worldly wisdom, to pursue his worldly dreams and to indulge in unrestrained enjoyment of the material world. And this is another part from his testimony. I went to church for some time. After some time, I got tired. I said, it's time to stop going to church. I had a lot more things to pursue. Girls, studies, sports, etc. After all, I had achieved all these things without God. Who needs God? Now, I said there are two clues. The second clue is more instructive. In chapter 12, verse 13, now all has been heard. This is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. After all is said and done, after all the thinking and pondering, this is what you need to do. Fear God and obey Him. This is what life is all about at its core. The teacher calls it duty. And fear God is not to be scared of Him. It means to revere Him. If you revere God, you would naturally keep His laws, because the two go hand in hand. But this begs another question. Why is that the meaning of life can only be found in God? Why is it that only God can provide the true meaning of life? The answer is simple but deep. You need to ponder over this. It's because we are created in the image of God. We are created to have a relationship with Him, to know Him, and to revere Him. It's in our DNA. So when a thing is made, but it's not used according to its original design, then all kinds of problems will creep in. You were made by God for a purpose. And that purpose can only be found in God, the source of your life. And outside of God, like the teacher found out, you will only find emptiness and futility. You will find meaning in life only if you conduct your life God's way, God's design, and not your way or your design, as I too have discovered over the years of life. But I say this, because as I said, this discussion is outside the scope of our text, and we will come back to chapter 12 later in August. Again, coming back to Dr. Teo, it's the last bit from his testimony. Happily for him, he found God again in his dying days. If I were to sum it up, I would say that the earlier we sort out the priorities in our lives, the better it is. Don't be like me. I had to learn it the hard way. This has happened. It gave me a chance to come back to God. Few things I've learned though. Trust in the Lord your God with all your heart. Love and serve others, not just ourselves. Coming to the last bit, having briefly discussed the true meaning of life, now we are now ready to look at the last part of our text. And there's the fifth segment, just three verses at the end of the chapter, where the teacher has a little advice for us, for those who know God. He says in verse 24, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. And actually says this a few times in other chapters. And what does this mean? This verse may be clearer from another version, which says, the best thing we can do is to enjoy eating, drinking, and working. I believe these are God's gifts to us. In other words, in the context of a relationship with God, of knowing God, we can and should enjoy eating, drinking, and working, while acknowledging that these things are a gift from Him. We should receive enjoyment as God's gift to us, and that explains partly our love for travel. But I must remind you again about the golden rule of life: everything in moderation. Make sure you are not enslaved by these things, that they do not become little gods in your life. And so you see, our text today ends on a happier note after all. The earlier pessimism and gloom give way to a measured and thoughtful perception, a perspective about life in the minds of God's people. And the teacher adds in verse 20, 25 and 26a, if this is the last bit, if without him, who can find or who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. Meaning, outside of a relationship with God, all physical pursuits of life will become burdensome. But those who please him, those who acknowledge the sovereign God, he grants his good gifts of not only joy, but also wisdom and knowledge. But I would like to end the sermon not with the last verse of chapter 2, but with a nuance from the last chapter, chapter 12. And my question to you is this: do you know the one true living God? Do you revere him? Do you have a relationship with your Creator? And when I say relationship, I mean a close, personal relationship where you can call him Abba, Father. Or have you been struggling with misplaced pursuits of life? Does your life lack the meaning and purpose you desire? May the words of the teacher encourage you to place your hope and trust in the Lord. Shall we close in prayer? Our Father in heaven, may each one seated here find true meaning of life in you, O Lord our God. May each one who has come to your sanctuary this morning live his days according to your eternal purpose, Almighty God. For apart from you, outside of you, all pursuits of life are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Be thou our vision, for we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.